Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, as Haiti continues to endure gang violence and political unrest, the local Haitian community and refugee support groups try to meet the growing need for assistance. Later in the program, a Jacksonville feature film spotlights mental health in the Black community. We talk to the movie's director and its star. But first, for family members and relief organizations on the First Coast, the violence and chaos in Haiti is both agonizing to watch and impossible to ignore. I'm joined now by Pierre Paul of the Coalition of the Haitian Community in Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here with you.
Glad to have you. Beatrice Alonso Gonzalez, who serves as the Haitian and Cuban Entrant Coordinator for Lutheran Social Services of Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here.
And Danae Leek, the agency's communications manager. Good morning, Danae.
Good morning.
For our listeners, we're also taking your calls, questions. If you have any experience in Haiti, we would love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and you can message us on social media. Pierre, you recently held a rally and a press conference outside of Jacksonville City Hall. Why did you choose this time, and what is it that you wanted to communicate to the community?
It's been a long time. Haiti been going through a lot of situation, and we have the Community International and been in Haiti trying to help. But unfortunately, it's a lot of failure as well. And we see for so long, and a beautiful country like Haiti, and good people, and we say that enough is enough. So we have to stand. All Haitians around the world have to stand and see if we can put our voice together and see if that can change the situation. And also, we kind of stand before the decision of our governor DeSantis when it's come to stop Haitian from coming to Florida and just to save their life by the situation that's going on, especially in Port-au-Prince.
And so your goal is to draw attention to the issue. You talk about the failure of the international community for a long time when it comes to Haiti, and very mixed results in some cases where there has been involvement. Is there anything that you think specifically would be helpful right now? And who, if out of the international community, should be leading that effort?
We have, for example, many organizations leading by UN. Went to Haiti, and where we have so a lot of things, instead of getting better, got worse. And also we have those agents or those people that they sent to Haiti, and they violate a lot of law and in Haiti, and a lot of code. As far as, for example, we have a sexual scandal. And we have especially the situation of the cholera that killed about, for in an interval of 6 years, killed about 10,000 Haitians. And then brought by, I think, is is it the UN, part of the UN peacekeeper?
Yeah, that was the peacekeeping agency, that arm of the UN that's brought and spread cholera.
Well, it's called cholera, exactly. Which I don't really remember the name of that organization. And the Community International, especially United States, Canada, and France, instead of helping the Haitian, to help Haitian lead themselves, come with a solution and support Haitian themselves, to lead themselves, they instead influence the political system in Haiti.
Mm-hmm. And try to kind of direct as opposed to allowing Haiti to...
Exactly. And that's been going for so long, over and over again, decades,
yeah,
where they set their own government and they set their own president in power. And so all these things contribute to the to where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Beatrice, there are the work that you do. You know, you are helping people who are coming from Cuba and Haiti.
Correct.
Who have needs there. Some of them are, you know, just migrants. Some of them are refugees.
Not necessarily. At least with this program, we only see entrance statuses or people who come through the humanitarian parole.
Okay.
No refugee status. That's another way to come into the country more with the government approved. And then they come here with a refugee status. Saying this is very hard to get a refugee status for Cubans and Haitians.
It's very difficult.
It's very difficult, yes. It must be something big in order to be approved by the government previously to come into this country.
So the people that you're helping that are coming from Haiti, explain how they're arriving here and what their path was.
Okay, they have, at the moment, they have two ways. They can, the most common one that has been using for years is coming through the border. So everything I'm going to say is based on what I see with my clients about their stories, everything that they expressed in our offices. For example, if they are in Haiti, they either can go to Dominican Republic, stay in there, or maybe go to Puerto Rico in a boat. Or they can go to the Bahamas, or they can get a ticket to Brazil, either Brazil or Nicaragua, and start the journey. If Brazil is the country that they are able to fly the first time, they might walk a little bit to, let's say, the most common one is Chile. In Chile, they stay there for a while, they make money, and then they continue the journey in order to come into this country. So it's a long journey for them. Saying this, when they are in the border, either Texas, Arizona, California, it doesn't matter right now. In the past, they received the entrant statuses, which is an I-228. Still, the government helped them. This is something that not a lot of Haitians knows, that the rights that they have, that the government support them. Another way, this is the most recent one, started last year on, I don't want to say an exact day, but I believe it was around March, through the CBP-1 application. This is a USCIS app, which once they arrive in Mexico, they have to download that application, ask for to schedule an appointment with immigration, and once they are there, they have to wait for immigration to give them an appointment. Saying this is a more legal status for them to enter this country and with more benefits. If they wait, it can be 3 weeks or it can be 6 months. You never know. It's like a lottery when you're gonna receive that appointment in the border. Mm-hmm. So saying this, if they wait for that appointment, they will receive an I-94, a parole for 2 years. In these 2 years, they can do a lot of stuff because they have the right, the government provide them support.
Mm-hmm.
So they can apply for work authorization with the parole. They can get it fast if they pay for it, which is $410. That's something that's another subject.
Issue.
Yes, it's another subject. Yes, they have to pay for that and they can get the work authorization faster.
I want to take a couple calls here. We've got Susan from Fruit Cove. Good morning, Susan. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I am aware of a really wonderful organization, a not-for-profit, who's been in Haiti since the 70s, late 70s or 80s, and they really work through with the Haitian people during a horrible, horrible earthquake. And they focus, it's called Partners in Health. So if people are looking for an organization that can help people and they listen to the people who are there, the people on the ground are Haitians and they're trying to help now in any way that they can. But the decisions are horrible because even the nutrition programs, it's hard to get food when there is no food. So I just encourage people to look up online, Partners in Health, and the Haitian people are incredibly resilient, and they've gotten through horrible things before, and they will. They will.
Well, thanks so much for your feedback, Susan. We also have a call, Don from Jacksonville. Good morning, Don. Go ahead.
Hi. The question is, and I think the lady speaking a few minutes ago maybe kind of answered lightly. Through the years of Haiti having conflict and poverty and disasters, hasn't the U.S. tried to make a coalition with nations like the Dominican Republic to help, or with Puerto Rico, instead of having that long route that was discussed about being sent to faraway countries and long stretches? Isn't there a way to work out something with Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, being a neighboring nation and an island of Haiti?
Yeah, it's a good question, Don. I know that we were talking, Danae, this morning about the fact that, you know, Haitians traditionally have tried to go to the Dominican Republic, which, of course, is the other side of that island. And currently they're being turned back or sometimes, you know, trucked back. That border is fairly well sealed right now. And there isn't necessarily a lot of other options for, a community that in many cases is poor and doesn't have resources. I mean, there are flights, but those are expensive. And the airport right now is, at least in Port-au-Prince, is not even operable.
Definitely, for sure. I can't speak a ton on it. I just know a little bit about like what I've read. I know Beatrice has read more about it.
Well, so what are the resources that are available through LSS?
Oh, absolutely. Lutheran Social Services of Northeast Florida. We've been in the community for almost 45 years, and our first program was hunger relief. And since then, we've had a food pantry open 5 days a week. But in 1980s, when we opened up our refugee services program, and so what's available is we have services available for Haitian and Cuban entrants. Mm-hmm. We have been for years, but Beatrice's program that launched in November has more nuanced services.
Yeah. What other communities have you helped over the years?
Cubans.
I'm talking about LSS writ large. You guys have done
absolutely.
A number of settlements, I think, of during the early days of the Ukraine war.
Yes.
A lot of Sudanese settlement here during that early conflict years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have been actually this past fiscal year. So the top nationalities that we have assisted, Cubans, Ukrainians as well, Haitians and Afghans were our top nationalities that we assisted in the last fiscal year, and we, along with our partners, have helped over 2,500 individuals, refugees or entrants, different statuses within our refugee services program. So, we have seen other individuals, like some individuals from Burma, but as far as like the top nationalities, it's been Cuba, individuals from Ukraine, Ukrainians, and Haiti as well.
And has the Jacksonville community traditionally been a welcoming place for those people to settle?
I would say yes.
I believe so. We have plenty of resources for them. Saying this, I would like them to know that some people, especially Haitian community, they don't know that they do qualify for government benefits, such as food stamps, Medicaid, and cash assistance for a period of 1 year.
Hmm. Pierre, how large is the Haitian community here locally?
That's a good question. I don't really have the data, but I talked to one of the immigration officer. It's been back 2017, and he said the effective may be over 70,000.
Okay.
2017.
So I imagine you still have some friends and family in Haiti, but you've lived here for a number of years. What is your path here? What brought you to Jacksonville?
First of all, I had my brother who'd been living in Jacksonville since 1993. When I decided to stay in United States, I chose Jacksonville since 2000 to stay. Mm-hmm. But I used to travel for over 2 years as a tourist, go back and forth, and never think that I would stay in United States because it wasn't my it wasn't my plan to stay, but unfortunately, and here I am. It's been over 20 years, but I have no regret because I learned so much and about people, about leadership, different type of culture.
I think a lot of people see images of Haiti and they think of this, very difficult situation. And certainly a lot of the country is experiencing, you know, problems with gang violence and unrest and, you know, sometimes just political chaos. But you say that there's parts of the country that are still, you know, remote from that, isolated from that. Tell us about that part of Haiti that maybe we're not seeing reported on quite so much. Yeah.
And Lekai is where I come from. That's the third city of United States, of Haiti. And Lekai and people are just having their normal activity every day. And we have the second part of Haiti, which is Le Cap. That's the second city. And a school open. And people, they normally have their normal activity. And also, we have a total of 9 departments in Haiti. And with many cities in all the departments. So generally, we have 80% of the capital being occupied by gang or gang.
80% of the capital.
80% of the capital. And we have also a few cities neighboring, close to the capital, also being controlled by gang. And I want to point out, and I want to thank for two people that just called, and to suggest and see how they can help Haiti. And I want to point out about the Dominican Republic. Actually, and it's all over the news that they have a campaign to stop everybody who hold a Haitian passport. It doesn't matter if you're from United States or anywhere around the world, even if you are a resident of United States or France or Canada, and you have a Haitian passport. Like, for example, I'm not a citizen. I'm not a Haitian American, but I have a residence. But now the fact that I'm not a Haitian American, I don't have an American passport. I do have Haitian passport. Now, if you told me to go to Saint-Domingue, the Republic
Dominican
Republic, and to go to Haiti, they would stop me at the airport.
They would stop you.
Yeah. So I don't know why, but that's coming from the government of the Dominican Republic, and not to accept any transit of Haitian who have a Haitian passport, actually.
We're talking about the situation in Haiti and resources available here in Jacksonville. We've got a couple calls I want to get to. Charles on the West Side. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead.
Yes, bon matin, mes amis. This is Charles. I 50 years ago, I got a degree in French from the Defense Language Institute in the Army, and ever since I got back to Jacksonville in the late 70s and the 80s, my friends in the Haitian diaspora have kept me proficient in French because I've always had some friends to speak to and keep my language in use, you know. I have a local friend that's a pastor that started a small church, a Baptist church here on the west side on Ricker Road a few years ago, and it's struggling, and, you know, they could use some help for the Haitian diaspora there, and I was wondering if I could give you guys the phone number of Pastor Bernard for his church on Ricker.
Go for it.
Okay, it's area code 904-573, and let me just get my glasses here, 573-9850.
Thank you, Charles.
That's Pastor Bernard.
Thanks so much. Appreciate that. We also have a call, I believe, Paul. Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir. You know, I've been in Jacksonville since 1994, and that gentleman you have there, Pierre, but, you know, we were together. But the concern now is about the Haiti's crisis. You know, I was running for office back in 2015. For last year, I spent about seven months in Haiti and just made it back by November. But the situation right now, the situation right now, as you were asking the questions, we have 10 departments within 10 states. And only Port-au-Prince, because we are from the south, was about 98 miles away from the capital. We have north, we have south, south, southwest. We have NIP that makes it 10 departments. Most places, most of them, they are very peaceful. Mm-hmm. But the problem, all the departments, they are depending on the capital. And now, right now, some places they are working, but as there is no transportation from the capital to get from one point to another, and if it's something, is an emergency for the whole country right now, because there is no access to gas, petroleum, there is no access to medical assistance. The gang members, because most of the time, the capital is the one feeding the other departments.
Right. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. I mean, it sounds like what you were saying, Pierre, that there is, this crisis in the capital is, in some ways, it's happening at the capital, but it has these impacts radiating out people who are fleeing the capital, first of all, to these other cities.
That's exactly. And people cannot go to other cities because where they have to go to go to other cities, to access other cities, and the gang get control of those things. And then one thing I want to point out as well is the movement of gangs change in a way like they kind of doing a terrorist action, mm-hmm. as far as burning school, burning pharmacies, and that's just across one of the biggest hospitals in Haiti. And so it's just this, they change the way that they doing those, they create more problem, more situation now.
Yeah, I mean, so that I think that the gangs have intensified their attacks. As you say, they set fire to a school. They've been looting pharmacies that are right across from the country's largest public hospital. And so there are, I think, people increasingly feeling, at risk personally and for their families. What do you hear from your clients in terms of their fears and their contacts, Beatrice, in Haiti?
Oh, yes, definitely. They are very scared about the situation. Some of them, they were able before the crisis exploded at this level. For example, recently I saw these unaccompanied minors that the parents had to make the hard decision to let them go through the border. That's a long story. And when they arrived to Lutherans, their story was heartbreaking. The things that they said, why they were forced to leave Haiti. Many family members were brutally killed as well while they were there. So they were forced to send the child to Nicaragua and from Nicaragua, start the journey. And actually saying this, they were lucky enough because not everyone, I believe you, Mr. Pierre, you know that a lot of Haitians don't have the monetary support in order to come here in this country. Not like, I don't want to compare, but this is the reality, not like Cubans or let's say Venezuela. I'm not saying all of them, but in general, they will find more monetary support from a friend, from a relative living here in the United States. But with Haitians, it's different. It's hard for them to get that monetary support. That's why they have to stay. They are forced to stay in X or Y country, either South America, Central America, learn the language. That's something that I admire for them. I don't know how. That's a gift that they learn the language very fast, make money, and then come here. And not only they have to face what they faced in Haiti, also the being the racist, being discriminate, everything during the journey, the cartels, people being really, really bad to them during the journey in order to come here. Saying this based on what I heard in my office, some of them are forced to leave behind their child. And who takes care of the child? A coyote, for example. Or just random people. And then that's how we see unaccompanied minors in the border.
Those are really difficult stories to hear.
You have no idea. Very, very difficult. But we are here to help them and let them know that now you are safe. And thank God you have the resources. The state is giving you the resources. LSS will help you to get those resources and help you with guidance, link to resources, to have a brighter future here. That's the reason that you are here in the United States. So they will get the help.
And what do you want people in the Jacksonville community to know who maybe are not directly involved with the community of, you know, people who've settled here who may not have those direct connections about the stories that you're hearing or what they should do?
Actually, we have an idea recently, Danae and I, we were talking about, because these people need to be heard. Definitely. And something that we were talking about that maybe we can make like short videos about the client stories. If the client wants to do it and feels safe to do it, they are more than welcome to do the video, tell their story and see how someone can support this person, this family.
Kind of sponsor an individual.
Exactly. Yes. Especially Cubans and Haitians. Trust me, there's plenty of stuff that people can do for them. Even though they have the government benefits, there's plenty of stuff that they can, many ways to support these people.
Yeah, Danae.
Yeah. And just to add on to what Beatrice is saying, at LSS, we do have volunteer opportunities, mm-hmm. Predominantly either within the hunger relief program or within our refugee services. And if you reach out to us, lssjax.org, send us an email or call us, and we can, you know, find an opportunity that best serves how you can assist and get involved.
Pierre, any final thoughts?
Yeah, sure. And I want to say thank you to Beatrice and Dina, and for all your help. And yes, my people deserve a more attention around the world, because and at a certain point, and one of the our story is after we destroy one of the biggest market in the world, which is the slavery, and we don't sit down in our country to enjoy our freedom. We go around the world to help other people to destroy the slavery that were going on around the world, and we have so many countries. So with our money, with boats, with people that we send, today is the time for us that we need help, and we need the international community to come with us and help us continue to with effort to build this country. And then actually, we have people, as we're talking, dying. So is it time for change for these people, these wonderful people?
Yeah. Well, Pierre Paul, Danae Leek, Beatrice Alonso Gonzalez, thank you so much for being here today and talking about this issue. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And stick around. Up next, our sneak preview of the annual Sleeping Giant Film Festival. It includes an interview with the local director of a featured movie. Welcome back. Mental health in the Black community is the focus of a locally produced independent film premiering this weekend at the Sleeping Giant Film Festival at Sunray Cinema. And I'm joined now by the creative minds behind the film, Far From the Tree, as well as the annual film festival's organizer. Jacksonville-based director Durden Godfrey, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Actor Taurine Royal, welcome.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And Shana David Massett, co-owner of Sunray Cinema and Five Points. Hey, Shana.
Hey, Anne.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Durden, what has inspired the plot of this film? Why did you want to tackle this particular topic?
My wife and I were watching the Netflix series Dahmer, and we are parents. And the part of that story that really stuck with us the most is the parents of Dahmer being put in that position.
You're talking about Jeffrey Dahmer, the serial killer?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. Couldn't imagine being a parent and having to deal with your child being that kind of evil. So that's kind of where the story birthed from, was mm-hmm. wondering, as a parent in that hypothetical, what you would do.
Yeah. And so, Taurine, you star in this film.
Yes, me and my daughter, Jayla Royal, yes.
Yeah, which is interesting that you're playing alongside your daughter. This is a story about a father and daughter
Correct.
Reaching a crisis. And I don't know that there's a one-for-one with the Dahmer movie, but there is some kind of crisis that occurs.
Yes, and of course, the reason why I chose to play the character is because I didn't want anybody else playing that character with my daughter. She's an actress as well. And the dynamic of what we were going to be talking about with mental health in the community, I just felt that it's going to take two talented actors who are seasoned in what they do to dive into that subject and then come back out. And because I've been training her since she's about 3 or 4 years old in acting, I knew she was mature enough to handle it. So I don't want to say I'm the star of the film. I feel like me and her are the stars of the film, but except the community is the real star, because that's what we're shining a light on, is about what we go through and how we see things.
How is it sharing the screen with your daughter? How is it communicating with her through that role?
I would say it's priceless. It's one of those things people can't take back from you. It's we get to leave a digital footprint to the world of what we did together as art that for those people who suffer from things like dementia or things of that nature, people will always be able to go out and see this. And it's something that no one will ever be able to take from me. So it's one of the greatest gifts I've ever had.
I want to give our listeners just a taste of what this film is about. And I want to hear a little bit from the trailer before we start to talk about the festival.
I feel defeated. I can give her the entire world, and Virginia will never be a part of it.
Tony, you bring Morgan to the place you propose to Virginia every year. Virginia is very much a part of the world you've given Morgan.
So it is a intense drama. That's actually a film that you share with a pretty well-known actress. Is that right?
Yes, Lila Robbins, yes.
And people will know her from Homeland mm-hmm. and Blacklist. And
I first fell in love with her on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles as yes. Steve Martin's wife at the end on Top of the Stairs. Yeah, she's been in pretty much everything.
She was a treat to work with. We flew up to New York to work directly with her and couldn't have been had a better, more professional time.
Shana, I want to talk about the Sleeping Giant Film Festival. It's back again. It's been going on since 2017, I think, maybe with a COVID.
This is number six.
Number six. All right. Tell us about the roots of the Sleeping Giant Film Festival. You and Tim started it in an effort to kind of give some offbeat, maybe films that are locally produced. There's cartoons, there's experimental films, there's performances. What's the overall gist of Sleeping Giant?
You caught a lot of them. It's to cover so many different areas of film exhibition and live music that can't fit in a schedule that focuses on making money off of the films that we are presenting every single show and the live music that we're presenting every single show. Just because the people aren't going to turn out in giant droves over a 2 or 3 week period like one would for content that we're used to seeing on new release screens like Sunray has. We want to have these films. We want to have that experimental piece. We want to have these local components. We want to have documentaries, old and new. And that doesn't happen always on a schedule that we would like. So for 4 days, we pack out that schedule with just some of the very most dynamic programming we can. And we do it with some help. This is the sixth year that we've been doing it, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without some other folks. And it's nice to see, you know, other other institutions in Jacksonville get into it. Like, this is the first year that MoCA's joined in. That's really exciting. This is the second year that Hoptinger, our neighbors across the street, they're down for this. And sixth year with Black Sheep Group on board. So it's a time that we all get together and say, hey, what's important to us? Making sure that we can see the films that anybody anywhere else should be able to see.
And it's not just films. I mean, you have brought in John Waters in the past. You had Sonic Youth guitarist Lee Ronaldo come in one year. You've had Juju perform. So there are bands, there's performance art. I mean, there's a whole variety of things mixed in with the films.
And there's the two together. There's silent films with live scores. That's our opening night, is City Symphonies, where in the 20s and the 30s, the city and some of these experimental pieces, including what's known to or called America's first avant-garde film, these short films are going to have live scores with a band from Chicago called Wine Cave. I'm especially looking forward to that. So that's just the kind of thing that fuses that film and music piece together.
In terms of the film, it's called Far From the Tree.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There is a very powerful, you know, message, and kind of a, you know, dramatic message that it shares. Do you think it is entertainment? Do you think that it offers some sort of educational component for people who are watching it?
I hope that it's a conversation starter between parents and children, between people, like, personally with themselves. To one of the main messages of the movie is just to keep your mental health in check and the consequences that could come out of not doing that, even when you have the best intentions. So that if anything, you know, I think people can find entertainment out of it. But most of all, I just hope that they leave talking about things that should be talked about more.
Talk a little bit about the movie making process, because I understand it was done on, you know, kind of a tight schedule. Explain how you did that, and all the little kind of working parts behind it.
Yeah, so this is not my first film. It's the first film that I did on my own. With independent productions, you're going to have a lot of personalities involved, and a lot of the times they're not getting paid. So as the director of the film, you feel like you need to compromise and let their voices be heard. So it's everybody's movie. And this film, I really wanted to do something that was without compromise. It was a singular voice from the beginning to the end. And the only way that you could really do that in Jacksonville is just to do everything yourself. So it was, for the majority of the production, it was myself, it was Royal, it was his daughter, and the three of us are very comfortable. We've worked together before, so there was that intimate dynamic even on the set that I think carried over into the film itself.
Shot over how many days?
It was a 6-day production, which included a trip to New York City to shoot with Lila.
That seems extraordinary.
It was taxing, yeah, but it's nice to, you know, God made the whole world, right, allegedly, in 6 days. So I think we could do a film in 6 days. And it just feels really good afterwards to just know that you're done, it's over with. Because, you know, doing a film is very, very taxing, not only on the filmmakers, but of the family of the people that are involved. So the quickest you could rip that Band-Aid off and it is better for everybody, I think.
Tareen, talk about that schedule for you as a performer.
Well, considering I can do what I call a fake job during the morning, because if you're not doing what you want to do in real life, then it's not your career. It's a fake job. But between the fake job and the real job of me being an actor, director, filmmaker, and a father, it's very taxing, as he said. But, you know, it's what I've always wanted to do in life. Anything worth having is worth working for. And again, it's you're doing something you love. And it's with my daughter. And it's that perfect work-life balance of understanding that we're going to get this thing done in 6 days. And also, we want to set the example to other filmmakers. You don't know what you can do until you do it. You set the time out for it. You stay focused. You fortify your mind, and you get it done. So I'm getting several lessons done at once. My daughter's seeing how you stick to something and stay focused and see it through. We're showing ourselves we can push ourselves to those limitations. And we're showing big-budget Hollywood films, hey, it doesn't take 6 months to get something right. You can do it in 6 days.
And so you say that you started training your daughter, J-Lo, very early.
Yes.
As an actress.
Yes.
Why? And What were you going for there?
Well, let's just be honest. I suck at sports and I don't have a son. So I had to do what I was great at. And it was, I just always envisioned it would be me and her. And one day I would be able to leave her something that the world couldn't take from her. So she would always work for herself and be independent. And it's just really what I loved. And it started with her doing, funny enough, Easter plays and making her remember the lines and going from there and showing her what range is. And the film we did a few years ago, I'm Gonna Kill Someone This Friday, where she had to play a pretty much psychopath serial killer at that point. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen it. But the point is that, like, people say, aren't you scared to have your daughter take on subjects? Yes, if she hadn't been doing this since she was 3 years old. You build on the character. And I'm self-taught and self-trained from watching movies my entire life and being pushed by this guy for 20 years to play different roles. So we were in our comfort zone.
How did you two get to know each other professionally? Was it a personal relationship?
Well, it was a twofer. One time through the film Lonely Hearts that was being shot here in Jacksonville, Florida, once I was an extra in. Not doing an extra anymore, guys. Prices went up. But we did that film Lonely Hearts, and then we were introduced to an intermediary. And then another gentleman by the name of Tarantino Jones. Happy birthday, Tarantino. Also got us together, and we started filming projects together. And we've been doing this for like 20 years. And so now it's gotten to the point to where we never wanted to be gatekeepers. That's not who we are. We give the knowledge back to the community. We don't forget where we come from. So it's been an experience, and I think we got about another 20 years in us after this, and we're just going to stop.
You all three are from Jacksonville, though, you and your daughter. And
yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how does that figure into the work that you do?
You know, I've heard when I first started making films, the dream was to leave Jacksonville and go to Hollywood. That was the ultimate dream. And that's really shifted over the last few years, or the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, with streaming services really picking up. And you know, you don't need to go to Hollywood, or you don't need to leave Jacksonville to make it. You know, Hollywood has kind of fallen by the wayside, and you're seeing these independent streamers and independent filmmakers really getting all the attention and getting the audience. I think the great thing about Jacksonville is that it retains that small town feel while being a big city at the same time, and the close knitness of the community here is everything. And I have to shout out Tim and Sunray Cinema, because through my whole film career in Jacksonville, they have always been a tremendous support to not just myself, but filmmakers in general in this community.
So this film screens Sunday at 12:45. Mm-hmm. That's this Sunday. But Shayna, just briefly, how can people get more information if they want to attend the other events?
Yeah, sleepinggiantfest.com, sunraycinema.com. If you're used to buying your tickets there, we'll take you right to all of those screenings. Or come in and see us, or call us on the phone, and we'll talk you through anything that you want to do. Because it is a different experience navigating a whole packed weekend of films that you're like, but I want to see this and this and this. And well, that's the point. Come spend the day with us.
Terrific. Well, I'm so glad that you're doing the Sleeping Giant Festival still. It's a terrific event. And thank you so much for being here. Durden Godfrey, Taureen Royal, Shayna David Massett, all of you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Anne.
And stick around. We'll be right back with what to look for and what not to look at during the April 8th solar eclipse.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you. Today in Music History is sponsored by Florida Eye Specialists. Now introducing the cataract surgery lens that can be customized to your lifestyle after surgery for a clear look back at yesterday's hits.
As the news gets more complex and changes through the day, you need more than just a quick headline check. Here and Now keeps you connected to your world between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as the news and the people shaping it are changing in real time. I'm Robin Young. Follow along on Here and Now, NPR News every weekday.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, why Oregon's groundbreaking experiment with decriminalizing possession of hard drugs is coming to an end. In 2020, voters overwhelmingly approved decriminalization, but painful results generated a backlash that spurred lawmakers to reverse course. We'll speak with New Yorker contributing writer Tammy Kim. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Abortion is back at the Supreme Court. In the U.S., more than half of those who choose to terminate a pregnancy do so using medication. This case puts that option at risk. But there's more at stake than future access to abortion medication. The power and reputation of the FDA also hangs in the balance. We break down the arguments and consider what's next, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Total darkness will envelop parts of North America on April 8th. Some ancient cultures believed a solar eclipse was a sign from an angry god. Maybe? Don't know?
All kinds of things. Yeah.
Joined now by our resident spaceman, Eddie Whistler, director of the Brian Gooding Planetarium. I don't know. Let's hear your explanation. Eddie, what is causing this?
It's really easy to envision. You have the sun, which casts light, just shining starlight on the surface of the planet, half of it every day. And you put something like the moon in the way, it's going to cast a shadow. And if you are in the shadow that the moon casts, then you are in a solar eclipse. It's semi-rare, but also frequent. It depends on the time scale that we're talking about. But we have one in the United States. It is the last one until 2044. I think, you know, one kind of touches on the United States, but then in 2045, one is coming to the back door of Jacksonville. Like we will be within an hour, maybe 2 hour drive of a total solar eclipse. But we have plenty of time. We could talk about that some other time.
We'll plan a road trip.
2045.
This time around, we're not going to get that kind of a look.
This time you get yourself some safety glasses for eclipses, certified ones, easy to find online. Go to NASA. They have all the specifics on that. But you can get yourself a pair of safety glasses from our store. We have a few hundred of them, actually. But they'll be all around town. When you see them, whatever they are, $2, $5, $10, just grab a pair. You need one pair for you and your family because it's a prolonged thing. For us in Jacksonville, it's going to look like the moon is taking a bite out of the sun, and we'll lose 72% at its maximum. And its maximum is at 3:05. It's a 2.5 hour event that starts at like 1:45. It goes to 4:20. And there you go. At the max, 3:05, that's when you're going to see most of it. But we're not going to be in a place where like there's an event and a countdown.
It's going to look sort of like a crescent sun.
It'll look like a crescent sun, but nothing will change in your normal day if you were just outside with your glasses not on.
It won't look
shadows
dim,
will
dark.
Look a little bit weird. You might notice a little bit of a dimming effect. And plus, your psychology tells you that these these celestial bodies, these big masses are aligning in just this kind of way. So, you know, you'll have the bedrock of somewhat of excitement, but, you know, it's nothing like what the people in totality are going to experience.
Yeah. So who is in totality? What is the path of totality?
So it starts in Mexico. It makes its way up through Texas and straight up into Indianapolis. Indianapolis is in Austin. Are really like two big cities that I know are in the path. My family is in Indianapolis, and my plan is to actually go and fly in.
Oh, fun.
And so this will be my first. And so anyways, going up through Indianapolis and northeast United States and out through Canada. If you were in the path of totality for this particular eclipse, you have about 4.5 minutes of totality. The maximum when all things are in the right position and the moon is as big as it possibly can be, you could get up to 7.5 minutes.
Is it like fully dark, or do you see this kind of like ring around that keeps some light going?
Ring around. so safe, you could take your glasses should come off if you were in the path of totality, and you would see the atmosphere of the sun, you would see the planets, you'd see the stars. All horizons would look like a nice deep sunset. So really cool stuff. For us in Jacksonville, you want glasses, otherwise you see nothing, and pay attention to the shadows. Really, take pictures of the shadows underneath your tree in the front or at school or at work before anything starts. And then at 3:05, take pictures of the shadows again and analyze and compare and contrast.
It is weird. I remember in 2017, there was a partial solar eclipse wherever yes. I was. And the shadows mm-hmm. were really weird, but I can't remember exactly why.
I'm not going to tell you then. Now you got to look. You're going to conduct this little experiment for yourself in a couple weeks.
I do remember that was very interesting, the shadows. So big important thing, though, about not looking. I mean, no matter who you see or know, looking at the sun, you really shouldn't look during this event.
Yeah, no, never. Mm-hmm. Everything about your eyes will scream to you. Stop doing what you're doing if you're looking at the eclipse. So just listen to those voices. And you can injure yourself.
Yes. And I know that you said that they're available in a lot of places. There's actually an eyeglass place at Town Center, a Warby Parker, that's going to be giving them out for free starting April 1st.
Yep.
But you can also create kind of a pinhole thing to review it through. And I know that you can download those some places online.
Check out all those little things that are homemade DIYs are going to be the best thing that we could do here in Jacksonville, because you know, not much is going to change about your day, but having glasses, making pinholes, going outside, paying attention to shadows, if you have young ones, or even for yourself doing experiments like that, take pictures of the shadows under that same tree at the different times and see how it changes.
Eddie Whistler, I hope you have a great trip to Indianapolis. You'll have to come back and let us know how it was.
And come see us on the 5th and the 6th in the planetarium. We're going to go in deep with eclipses and we'll melt your mind.
Terrific. Well, it's always good to have you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem.
And
cheers.
That's our program. We encourage you to send feedback or suggestions to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock or find our entire archive at wjct.org or your favorite podcast platform. Tomorrow on First Coast Connect, the daughter of a wrongfully convicted death row inmate reveals how she hopes to carry forth his legacy. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.